Hello and welcome to episode 88 of the Tech Reformation, where the world of technology meets the worldview of Christianity. I'm Ben.
I'm Craig.
I'm Derek.
And this is Pink.
Well, guys, we've all agreed to do a good old-fashioned Theology from the Headlines deep dive on the Google Memo this week.
That's right. We all wanted to bring this to the table, so we just decided, hey, you know what? Let's break our format that we just newly created and do it the old way.
In God's kind providence, we had unanimous agreement where we usually do not.
It's like a flashback episode to season one with a current topic from season two. It's a little bit like Lost in that way.
Yeah, we're also the only podcast I know of that had a 76-episode long season one. But hey, what do you know? Season two. Here we go. This topic, which the internet sort of exploded with this past week, so maybe everyone listening knows, but I want to just give a quick summary of what's been going on. There was a 10-page long memo released by an employee of Google at the time who has since been fired because of the content of the memo. Executives such as the CEO, Sundar Pichai, as well as their diversity and inclusion chief executive, that's not the real title, but the person who's responsible for that at a corporate level, have both released responses. The employee was fired. His name is James Damore. And we've got the full content of the letter. We've all read it, and we've read lots of things that were helpfully posted in the Slack all week about this topic. And we just want to try and tackle it from a Christian perspective. And so first off, to introduce it, I'm just going to read James's own words at the introduction of the letter that I think helpfully summarize his main points. And then we will roll into discussing the various main points and a few other, I hope, helpful things regarding this whole memo. So here we go. In James's words, I value diversity and inclusion, am not denying that sexism exists, and don't endorse using stereotypes. When addressing the gap in representation in the population, we need to look at population-level differences in distributions. If we can't have an honest discussion about this, then we can never truly solve the problem. Psychological safety is built on mutual respect and acceptance, but unfortunately, our culture of shaming and misrepresentation is disrespectful and unaccepting of anyone outside its echo chamber. Despite what the public response seems to have been, I've gotten many personal messages from fellow Googlers expressing their gratitude for bringing up these very important issues, which they agree with, but would never have the courage to say or defend because of our shaming culture and the possibility of being fired. This needs to change. And then he gives a list of bullet points summarizing his main contentions. First, Google's political bias has equated the freedom from offense with psychological safety, but shaming into silence is the antithesis of psychological safety. Second, this silencing has created an ideological echo chamber where some ideas are too sacred to be honestly discussed. Third, the lack of discussion fosters the most extreme and authoritarian elements of this ideology. And he defines extreme as all disparities in representation are due to oppression, and he defines as authoritarian as we should discriminate to correct for this oppression. And then finally, differences in distributions of traits between men and women may, in part, explain why we don't have 50% representation of women in tech and leadership. Discrimination to reach equal representation is unfair, divisive, and bad for business. So those are James's main points. I think I see maybe four main contentions in what I've just summarized and in the whole memo, the first of which is that there are biological differences between men and women. So let's start there.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, are there biological differences between men and women?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Just even speaking from what we know of the Bible, men and women have different roles in the church, in the family. What I want to make sure we're not saying when we say that is that I don't want this to come off like we are saying men and women, like there is a status difference between men and women such that men are better than women in general or women are better than men in general. We are equals in this world that we live in, though we may have different roles.
Yeah, I think the equality of the sexes of male and female is one of the most foundational presuppositions of the Bible.
Yeah.
That both men and women are made in God's image equally.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is no inferiority in the case of either men or women. So when we say different, we do not mean to communicate that there is inferiority in the case of either.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And I think often when we have this discussion, especially us as like four white males, like I really don't want people to think that when we say women are different this way, that we are saying women are inferior this way. Or
right.
that if men are different this way, that men are better this way. That's not what we're saying at all. So clarification out of the way, I think we can proceed. I just wanted to make that very clear right off the bat.
I was just going to say that that is part of... people thinking of difference that way is probably something. It's important we make this clarification right at the beginning, like you said, Derek. There will still be people who listen to this episode and read difference equals inferiority, because that's the way that the culture we live in continues to frame and control the conversation and push in that direction. And that's part of the problem that this guy has faced at Google, where when he tries to say, no, I'm not, I'm not anti-people, I just think that we need to look at this differently, people still say to him, no, you're anti-people. So, the clarification is important. It's also important to be aware that we live in a world that wants to get rid of that clarification and just look at it in a very narrow way, which is difference must equal superiority and inferiority. And I think that's part of the whole issue that's being addressed here.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I think this contention is the most divisive in our culture. This is the one that I think the news media has been reacting the most against, even to the point of, I think, misrepresenting the man's actual point. One of the main, I think, distinctions that he's making here is he's looking at population averages. So on average, women, one of his points is on average, women prefer people or empathize with people more, and men on average empathize or prefer processes more, things. And I think people have taken that generalization and zeroed it in on one individual person and said, therefore, this can't be true for you. And that's not what he's doing at all.
Right, right. Exactly.
He's just saying, let's not ignore the averages.
I thought it was really interesting on this, normally one of the concepts that comes up when you speak about biological differences and inherent differences are things like, should women be in leadership and those kind of questions. His argument was for the biological diversity was an explanation, I guess, for why more women are not necessarily in leadership, as opposed to saying women shouldn't be in leadership. And so he said, most people seem to put people into groups and grouping people or like tribal. But he said, every single person should be looked at on an individual basis. And so is this person a good leader? Yes or no? And then therefore, yes, make them a leader. No. Okay, they don't need to be a leader. And we don't need to force 50% of people have to be 50% of the leaders have to be women, 50% men. And I thought that was interesting because I feel like that is what, at the root of the gender equality movement is treat every person on an individual basis because they're all equal and look at where they're skilled at. And so I feel like in many ways he was agreeing with kind of the heart of that movement. But I think the movement sees that in general, even though it's impossible to look at people as an individual basis because of stereotypes. Mm-hmm.
There seems to me to be some equivocation on the word equal in what you, I think, referred to as the gender equality movement. I think some people, when they say equal, are using a word that means same, which is not what I mean by the word equal. There are differences, and yet there is equality. That's what I want to say. I think that's what the Bible says. And so equal and same are not the same word. They don't mean the same thing. They're not synonymous.
The only way they're the same is that to have equality means to have the same value, right? It doesn't mean to be the same in every way. It just means the same inherent worth, and that's where equal lies.
With regard to image of God, worth, value, and dignity are equal among men and women, and individual men and women, not just the population. But I think there is a presupposition that any difference at all means that there is inequality. And the trouble with that is that when you look at the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, there is difference, and yet there is equality.
Yeah.
So I don't think I can take that presupposition seriously.
I think another big part of the biological differences thing here is that most of the time he is not talking about ability being different for the majority of things. Okay. Many times men and women have very equal ability to accomplish things in business. However, pushing people against their interests is not in the interest of running a good business or in the interest of helping someone having a fulfilling career.
Or the interests of those people.
Right,
you're not actually helping them.
Exactly. So part of his point is that pushing 50% of women to become coders may not be beneficial to most of those women. You want to encourage the women who are coder, who really want to code, to be, yes, go learn to code. Here's resources. Do this thing. We would love to have you do this. And the same with men who are also interested in that. But assuming that an equal number of men and women are going to be interested in the same thing is not really effective leadership. You're not helping your people to become what they can be really good at.
So I think that actually gets to one of the main reasons people push for 50-50 equality or representation, maybe I should say, among at least men and women in like STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and something else that starts with M.
Mathematics.
Thank you. Math. Yeah, that one. I think the goal or the virtue or the value is that we would have diversity of thought. That's really what we mean when we say diversity, because there are complex problems to solve, and I don't think about things the way even just you guys think about things, but certainly that women think about things, or non-white people think about things, or people with different socioeconomic statuses or educational backgrounds. I just don't think about those certain things, especially difficult problems, in the same way as all those people. And so you want to get as many different people in the room as you can in order to solve the problem the most effectively, especially, and somebody brought this up in the Slack, when you're doing something that's user-facing, where, I mean, frankly, I build websites, and it's just not true that white evangelical millennials are the only consumers of my website, right? And I don't want to exclude them just because they're not like me. So I think it's a good value. I think the diversity, the desire for diversity and the desire for inclusion is a good value in as far as we're not including inherently sinful things, of course. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have to make that clarification with you guys, but for the sake of anybody listening, I will.
And Damore is not against diversity at all in this screed. Like, he is
all
for...
It's not even a screed.
I don't even know what screed means, particularly.
It's 10 pages. It's kind of a screed.
A long speech or piece of writing, typically one regarded as tedious.
Anyway, he is totally for diversity. Like, having diversity of thought is a fantastic thing. He's just taking exception with the way Google and many other tech companies are approaching this issue. So,
yeah, I think his main points is that the effort they're going to try and accomplish the good value that they have is doing the opposite thing, which is really ironic. But I think that's part of our sort of second point. So we've talked about biological differences. The sort of second main point, if I can summarize, is ideological echo chambers. So he says, and that's his phrase, Google is one, that there's this, and we've done a whole episode on echo chambers, episode 77, Living in an Echo Chamber. Mm-hmm. You can go listen to that show if you want more info on this topic specifically. But the idea is you're surrounded by people who agree with you. You're never challenged by differing views.
And the amusing thing about that is that, or the ironic thing, I suppose, is that Google presents itself as being very okay with external views. You know, one of my favorite videos to watch on YouTube, or at least to share with non-Christians, has been Tim Keller's Reason for God Google Talk. So Google is not a Christian business, but they'll have a really prominent Christian pastor and author come in at a lunchtime and basically give his best possible, evangelistic spiel to a group of employees. So they kind of present as we're open to new ideas, we're open to different opinions about things, but then when it comes to the way they operate as a business, as a place that hires and fires people, that seems to go out the window in favor of their preferred ideology.
Yeah, some of those talks at Google have like really blessed me. One of them in particular was one of the best I've heard from John Piper. Was Jesus egomaniacal or was he an egomaniac? And just in very John Piper fashion at Google, he just walks through the issue with a simple syllogism and it's amazing. It is so good. And it's even a little hard to believe, I think, that he's at Google, but he is. And there's another one that I've been working through recently by a gal who is arguing against abortion from a very civil but thoughtful perspective as well. That's another talk at Google. So yeah, it seems like they are open to these ideas, but this guy who works there is saying they're not.
So along with the idea of ideological echo chambers, is Google has a very left-leaning bias, which there's some good things about that, but it's not very self-examining. They don't self-examine those biases very much. He talks in here about how Google really pushes constantly about examining like unconscious biases regarding genders and races and that sort of thing, which is a good thing. But they also take these values, these moral biases, to an extreme, because those moral biases are kind of baked into the company. And so without examining them, it takes them to some conclusions, like discriminating against certain people groups in order to include other ones that aren't perhaps wise. There's a place in the middle that's perhaps better. So there's just not examination of this, which is why James Damore has put this forward in the company.
I think the hard thing about ideological echo chambers, especially the one that James Damore is describing, is that it can bring the company or the group all the way to setting up the other ideas as villainy. And yeah. So you're trapped in your echo chamber, you know, and that's what he says in his article, is that they make this a moral issue. And then once it becomes a moral issue, if you have ideas other than their morals, then you're evil. And, I mean, obviously this is a little extreme, but it would be in a sense saying like, well, we don't want murderers to work at this company, you know, 'cause it's a moral issue. Mm-hmm. And so once you set those people up as the villain, you have no reason to listen to them because that's just insane. And that's what the lady, the Google representative at the bottom says, of this article. Her response is like, that it is what his article is inherently wrong because it goes against our morals and therefore he is evil and therefore we shouldn't listen to him.
Yeah, I think we've moved squarely into the third main contention, which is that in this ideological echo chamber, there is a silencing of those who don't fit in, those who disagree, those who have convictions otherwise, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that makes that really clear is his firing, obviously. Tank was mentioning one of the executives' comments. The CEO made similar comments about how these views are dangerous. Mm-hmm. His views are expressed dangerous, incorrect assumptions about gender. But I think one of the things that I've found to be helpful is the following quote. Our culture has accepted two huge lies. The first is that if you disagree with someone's lifestyle, you must fear or hate them. The second is that to love someone means you agree with everything they believe or do. Both are nonsense. You don't have to compromise convictions to be compassionate. Now, I don't like everything that Rick Warren does, but that is a darn good quote and commentary on our culture.
That is a good quote. I've read that before somewhere.
That has stuck with me ever since the first time I heard it. I just think it's so true. This culture of tolerance is inconsistent and self-refuting because you only tolerate someone who agrees with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Greg Kokel talks about the same thing. And so does, I think, D.A. Carson. He talks about the intolerance of tolerance. That idea is so true. And I think it's, if we just quickly go into a little bit of worldview, I think it's to do with the fact that there's this sort of this longing for goodwill between people and peace and equality and all these good things. There's good intentions behind, I guess, what ends up being the outworking that can be negative, like the silencing of the people with different views. There's good reasons that our culture and in this case, Google are sort of wanting to drive towards those things. But without the Christian worldview sort of reminding you constantly that at their core, everyone, you know, male and female are created equal, different people groups are created equal in the image of God. Without that sort of balancing aspect, that then you have the sort of totalitarian or extreme authoritarian sort of outworking of a desire for those good things, if that makes sense, which then kind of skews the whole thing into what's actually a net negative, because you've got people working to squash one sort of section of the population in order to sort of, work for the good of the others. So,
yeah, friend of the show, Tim Challies, which, by the way, I love saying that, friend of the show, Tim Challies. We had him on once, episode 46. Go check it out. It's our most popular episode, and it is a great summary of what we're trying to do here. Anyway, friend of the show, Tim Challies, came out with an article today, I think it was, The New Old Way Our Culture Pressures Us to Conform. And he goes through the sort of three cultures around the world that sociologists have identified: the guilt innocence culture, the fear power culture, and the shame honor culture. And he talks about how the Western world, you know, so countries like the US, the UK, Australia, have the global West, that sort of culture has been historically a guilt innocence culture. So we have laws around everything, and your laws you've broken, you pay a fine for, and you serve a jail sentence. Not that that's wrong, but that's just the culture we come from. All of our laws are carefully codified, he says. We're moving now to a shame honor culture, where if you disagree with the main cultural movement, then you are shamed until you earn your honor back by changing your views or by being silenced and not expressing your different views. Very helpful article I've linked in the show notes.
Would you say you're shamed until you honor the prevailing view of the culture?
Yes, I would say that. But I think maybe one of the most helpful things in the article is how he talks about how the gospel addresses each of these three cultures. That through the cross, Jesus Christ took our guilt to give us innocence. He bore our shame to give us honor, and he overcame Satan to take away our fear and give us power. The gospel transcends every culture, and in that way has a powerful message for all of humanity. That's Tim Challies.
Yeah, it's good.
And so let's move into the fourth sort of bullet point that we've been working through here. Pendulum swinging solutions. We've talked a little bit about this. We have some have these good values that they're trying to accomplish. And they implement these solutions where we're going to have 50-50 representation, and it sort of has the opposite effect that we hope. And yet we keep pushing further and further. The pendulum sort of swings, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, there needs to just be analysis of implementation of these ideas going forward. Like this, like the 50-50 thing, is probably a good idea in response to discovering there are gender biases that discourage women from being a part of a particular workplace. You want to eliminate that. So you want to find solutions to counteract that. However, like what Damore's discussing is that perhaps Google has swung the pendulum too far in the other direction in discouraging men discriminating against men for women in certain ways, potentially. I don't know how all that works actually inside their hiring process, so I don't want to speak too much detail on that. But he's saying maybe let's bring it back a little bit, you know, continue to refine and continue to study. Don't let our ideological, moral, values on this particular issue keep us from studying the issue further and, you know, bringing it back to something that works towards the goal that we were trying to do better.
And I think the reality here is that we've been confronted now with information that seems to conclusively demonstrate, if not prove, that not all of these issues are the result of some gender bias that we all implicitly have.
Right. There is like there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that was just released today, I guess, as we're recording this. It was talking about Sundar Pichai should resign as Google CEO. He goes through, he's got some quotes, he or she.
He.
I'm not sure. He got some quotes from some psychologists, scientists saying, you know, this guy, what he's saying, like everything that he said empirically is pretty much scientifically accurate. Like he's not off base about this. He's not making assumptions. He's taking studies and like, here these are something that we should consider. He's not as off the reservation as a lot of people have said that he is.
Yeah, another article I read was talking about the fact that there was a single study published in 2015 that claimed that male and female brains existed along a mosaic and that it isn't possible to differentiate them by sex. But this has been refuted by 4 academic studies since that time. So in the last 2 years, 4 academic studies have supported the idea of actual biological differences between male and female on that level. So it's hard to actually, scientifically, it's hard to sort of pretend it doesn't exist or explain it away.
Right.
It's interesting that people like us typically get in trouble for disagreeing with science because of strongly held convictions, because the opposite seems to be happening here. But
but people would say we only agree with the science when it agrees with us. People would accuse Christians in that way of being in their own echo chamber, of finding the science that agrees with them. But this isn't saying for evangelical Christian academic studies. This is just saying for academic studies. And I think a lot of the time, that's a lack of people understanding that science and faith can coexist. They don't have to be polar opposites.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there is truth to that. Like, we want to be careful of getting in our own ideological echo chamber and putting moral truths on things, like creating moral truths for things that aren't actually, you know, that aren't actually specified by the Bible. Like, there are parts, there are things that we can believe that can be one way or the other, that people can sometimes put, you know, hard moral grounds on, which is where we get in trouble with being inside an ideological echo chamber of our own. So we do want to be careful of that.
So you're saying legalism is bad?
Yeah, there you go. Yep.
Legalism is bad, and license is also bad. They're two opposing ends of the same spectrum, and they're both wrong, and they're both prevalent in our culture. So that's another thing where we as Christians have to somehow find that middle line.
Frankly, it's going to always be an issue. We're always going to run into this. We always just need to be aware that this is a thing and to, you know, avoid it as much as we can.
We ended up back in balance again, which is an old, another throwback from the show.
Season 1. Yeah.
But now that it's happened at least twice that I've noticed, I have to do this. I was going to not for the sake of time, but I have to.
Okay.
Because we did it again. And here it is. I think one of the strongest apologetics for the Christian faith, for the truth of the Christian faith, is the doctrine of the Trinity and the philosophical question of the one and the many. If you want more on this from somebody way smarter than me, read Van Til, Cornelius Van Til, who he develops this idea. But there, philosophers argue and debate about this issue of, we live in a world of one and many. So personhood is a good example. We're all persons, but we're not the same person. Or like even my own personhood. I'm still Ben. 10 years ago, I was Ben. And yet 10 years ago, me and today me are not the same person. So there's one Ben, and yet there's many Bens. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What explains this? What transcendent one and many explains the existence of our everyday experience of one and many? Only the doctrine of the Trinity does. And what the world does, I'm using the word world in the biblical sense, what the world, unbelievers, do is they swing on this pendulum at the bottom of a triangle, of which the Trinity is at the top, where there's a land of not many, and there's a land of not one. And so the denial of God works itself out in one of those two ways. Either there's not many, which is the culture of tolerance. There's not many. You must believe what I believe and tolerate only the people I believe. Or there's the not one. So that would be maybe like a... Well, also, there's a secularist perspective of that as well, where all roads sort of lead to the same place, and it doesn't really matter. What's true for you is true for you, and what's true for me is true for me, kind of thing. So it's a denial of the many and a denial of the one, of the transcendent one and many, that exists only in the Trinity, where we have one God, one being, eternally existing in three persons, many, one in many, one and many. And so when we talk about legalism and antinomianism, which is licentiousness that Craig was just talking about, the sort of evangelicalism middle road, the gospel-centered alternative, is where the Trinity, the revelation of the Trinity, comes down from the top of the triangle. And inasmuch as we are in line with the revelation of God, we walk that sort of middle balance road between the two extremes, the denial of the one and the denial of the many. I've seen this triangle show up so many times in things I've read. I don't know if everyone realizes it consciously or not, but I've seen it come up so many times. One popular example is C.S. Lewis says the devil sends error out into the world in two extremes. He wants you to deny one so that you'll embrace the other. That's a triangle right there. The world is wanting to push you away from one side so far that you embrace the other side of error. When instead we need to walk the narrow middle road of trusting God in his word, balance.
Can I just add something to that? I think I totally agree, and I think that's a really good analogy, very helpful. When you were talking about the pendulum swinging at the bottom and the Trinity kind of being the anchor at the top that's actually in the correct position where we should be taking our cue from, like you said, that comes down and we are supposed to line up with that. I think the Trinity is, there are lots of things that the Trinity has that we as creatures in this world don't have. One of those things is you mentioned that the Trinity is eternal and unchanging. It's always been, it always will be. And our culture lacks that property. So when you were talking about the Ben today and the Ben of 10 years ago, instead of our culture looking to the Trinity and realizing that there is a being who is eternal and unchanging and he sets the standard, he controls right and wrong. He controls, the value of humanity comes from the Trinity. We sort of expect that everything in our existence, including standards and morality and all that kind of thing, changes over time as we change over time. And I think that's where our culture gets into this swinging from one side to the other, because we go, well, now we actually think this way. Now, you know, we used to think 100 years ago, we thought this was right, but now we've progressed. And so now we think this is right. And we aren't anchored to a central point that says, no, this is right, no matter what time and place you're in. And I think that's where the problem sort of derives from.
I just got to say, that's very interesting. I'm very glad you mentioned that. And I'm going to now think about that for the next week and a half.
Again, that's not me. I just read people who are really smart, like Van Til. And Van Til's apologetic, in as much as I understand it, is based on the doctrine of the Trinity and the problem of the one of the many, as I've just explained.
Really cool. Let me take a moment here to do a quick break to tell you about our very special sponsor for this very special episode of Tech Reformation, and that is Missionalware, where you can go to get your lifestyle on mission to the glory of God. Missionalware is the Reformed theology gift shop with shirts, coffee mugs, coffee tumblers, Bible covers, all sorts of things to broadcast your faith and show your love of our history and reformers and all that good stuff. If you weren't aware of it, Missionalware has updated a bunch of their shirt listings to include tri-blend and tri-blend v-neck tees. There's also fitted shirts in the women's listings too. So got to check all that out if you haven't been there for a while. It's fun to just go and see what all new designs they have. They've updated a bunch of their designs as well. It's always fun for me to window shop, at the very least. They've got new Charles Spurgeon shirts. Of course, the 500 years of Reformation is coming up this October, so you want to get your 500 years of Reformation t-shirt before that happens, so you can proudly wear it as a member of the Protestant Reformation. Missionalware has been doing stuff for over 6 years, so they have a huge library of designs and items that appeal to any theologian, whether you've just now started discovering our history or whether you've been a nerd for years. Check them out at missionalware.com, and thanks to them for sponsoring the show this week.
So we've addressed four main concerns from James, and at the end of his 10-pager, he gives a couple, actually several, examples of what practically we could do about these problems that he wants to see addressed. And so I'll just mention one that I thought was really relevant to me as a programmer. Understanding that biologically, there's a difference that women prefer people and men prefer things. He says that we can encourage in programming more pair programming, which emphasizes people over things, in order to more evenly include or more equally include women in STEM jobs, for example. I think that's great. I pair program a lot. I think that's super practical and easy for us to do that I think is very possible as a result of all this. What did you guys think were particularly helpful? Or did you think of ideas that he didn't mention?
There was one point that I feel like was a pendulum swing in the other direction, was the de-emphasize empathy thing. So basing your decisions completely on empathy, not a great decision, which I think is what he's going for. But I think he's kind of pendulum swinging to the other direction of be emotionally unengaged so that you can make the right decision. I think it's both there. Like you have to be able to look at the facts and be able to empathize with the people that are having problems in order to have a good solution. But I think generally
But from a business perspective, he's right, isn't he? I mean, in that I think as any good boss would want to be showing empathy to their employees because that's a way of showing love to them, and that's important. But I think, I'm not 100% sure on this, but it sounds like he's arguing for when we're running a business at the end of the day, we need to make sure that the business is operating effectively, and that will sometimes mean making hard decisions that aren't necessarily going to look empathetic to the people who are involved.
Well, but then you're making decisions for the one, not the many. So you have to make decisions for both, right? The business is one and many at the same time. Just so throwback
sure,
about five
sure,
minutes
but,
ago.
But our business is heading, business's agenda is set by a board or whatever, and it's heading in a particular direction. And so the many, by being a part of that business, the many are subscribing to the direction of the one in that way. I think there's just a blurry line there, but I think you're also right. I think a good business will operate in both fields, not just have complete coldness towards its employees. That's not going to work.
But aside from that, like demoralizing diversity, confront Google's biases, like there's generally like reasonable things to bring up. I certainly don't see it as fireable material.
Yeah, it seems uncontroversial to me again.
Yeah.
But it's been very controversial.
Yeah.
I think if I sort of had to pick one, just sort of quickly looking back through his sort of his concluding doc points, one that I thought was quite interesting was it's under the heading of prioritize intention. And he says, our focus on microaggressions and other unintentional transgressions increases our sensitivity, which is not universally positive. Sensitivity increases both our tendency to take offense and our self-censorship, leading to authoritarian policies. Speaking up without the fear of being harshly judged is central to psychological safety. And I think that's sounds pretty true to me. I think that is a problem in a lot of our culture, tech companies maybe more so than elsewhere. That idea that, you know, everything that someone says, even if they're actually just stating a fact, is something I can get offended about or should get offended about. And therefore it's an act of aggression and needs to be sort of dealt with accordingly and punished and all that kind of thing. It probably goes back to the shaming thing that Ben was talking about earlier. That's part of our culture. But I think that's a big part of, you could extrapolate that out from Google to like, that's just inherent in so much of what's going on at the moment with a bunch of different sort of minority movements or social justice movements that's how they frame their, whatever their beef is, whatever their, you know, their thing that they're fighting for, they frame it around anyone who disagrees with that or has anything to say about it that's not 100% heading in the same direction in supporting it is aggressive and offensive and needs to be dealt with in that way. So I thought that was an important thing to recognize and then try and, hate to say it, but be balanced against that, you know, kind of work against that and bring it back to there are some things that are just factually true and whatever. So interesting.
I not to make light of a very serious subject, but the funniest, a lot of funny things have come out of this past week. as a result of the situation. And the single funniest thing that I have read on the internet is from some website called McSweeney's. Somebody shared this in the Slack. I think it was Brad. Where a Google manufacturing robot believes humans are biologically unfit for tech jobs. And it's in the show notes. If you read nothing else, read this. It's hilarious.
It is really funny. Yes.
That's one practical thing you can do about this problem. Read this article and have a good laugh. Don't take yourself so seriously, everyone. All right. So final section in this conversation this week, we asked in the Slack, which you can join by going to slack.techreformation.com. Anyway, we asked in the Slack what listeners would be helped by us talking about, and people submitted various questions. We grabbed a couple that we thought would be helpful, and we're just going to briefly mention them and respond to them as we can. First up, from Grant Baker in the Slack, I'd like to hear about what you think a Christian response can be working in the same situation. So guys, put yourselves in James's shoes. You're a Christian, though. And what do you do about it?
You know, this is a lot based on my personality, but I definitely wouldn't be so, like, you know, upfront with an article and all that. Just not saying what he did was necessarily wrong to voice his opinion, but I wouldn't have done that. I think for me, and I have, you know, more of a evangelism style mindset, if I were working in a place like Google, and I would be more centered on how can I bring these people to love Jesus. And so if issues like biological differences were such a huge deal, as long as I didn't have to go against what I believe is right to fit in with the company, you know, like I wouldn't really often argue the point of biological differences. I would more focus on, you know, what are the bridges that I can talk about with people that makes them see Jesus as Savior. And so I don't know the exact details on that, but I think I would overall avoid the topic and focus on other bridges that are less controversial, as opposed to really trying to make sure everyone believes the biological difference thing. So I think that's where I would be.
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't bring up the whole biological differences thing either. I would just figure out how to build bridges with people. You know, try to put forth. Because this is not my personal style, putting out a memo like this, because I just don't write very well. Or it takes me 2 days to write like a paragraph. You know, connecting with people one-on-one is a great way to really communicate, truth, especially in a culture that values empathy so much and is really for like looking at the individuals. Just practically really getting that one-on-one interaction is really effective in our culture right now.
As I understand the situation, one of the things that James did was write this thing up and send it out to a few key individuals in the organization to try and start a conversation around these issues rather than publish it publicly, which I'm not sure he ever published it publicly.
No,
I think it was
leaked. Didn't. Yeah.
In as much as that's true, I don't have as much issue personally with you know, wanting to discuss some of these issues. I think it seems like he wants the best for Google and the people at Google, which is a good thing. I think for me, the most practical thing I've got to accept, and maybe somebody listening is like me in this, is that I've got to be willing to lose my job for Jesus. And so for me, in as much as it's a biblical word of God gospel issue, I've got to be willing to take the stand, here I stand, I can do no further, and be willing to accept the consequences. I'm not saying that that's necessarily what this was, but if I can broaden the question a little bit to something a little bit more practical for me in my job, then that would be my response. We've got to be proclaiming the gospel, whether it makes people comfortable or not. And if we're getting if we're in positions where we might be fired because of evangelism, in some situations, maybe you're like stealing time from the company and not doing what you're paid to be doing, which is also sin. But in as much as you're just being a good Christian, doing good work and trying to proclaim the gospel so that people will repent and believe in Jesus and have eternal life with God, you've got to do that. Like, we have to do that. We don't have a choice. Our lives are not our own.
Yeah, I'd like to know whether he wrote the 10-page memo on company time or not. I'm assuming he probably didn't. I wouldn't have if I was him. I think what Tank was saying about sort of witnessing to individuals and being evangelistic in the workplace is certainly a good thing and is a right thing for us as believers to do. I think, though, that if I was working in a place like Google, where it's such a big machine with so many working within that big one organization, I think it would be pretty hard each day to go in and purely just love the people around you on that level and not pay any attention to what's going on at the company level. And so I think it seems to me like this is something that James has been struggling with for quite a while in terms of just trying to sort of put up with it maybe. And now this seems like this is like these are my thoughts about this problem that exists. And I've thought long and hard about it, and here's what I think we should do. And sure, the purpose of it was to start a conversation, but it seems like it's not something he's written in 5 minutes because he's noticed something one day that's annoyed him. And so I think if it was me, I would have done something similar. You know, I think it's important to, in these situations, go to whoever's in leadership and address the issue, which would lead to, I guess, with knowing the way that Google operates, what Ben just said of at the end of the day, it's then up to the leadership, the people who are in leadership positions, to react how they react. And if they then haul you over the coals for having certain thoughts or opinions, or if they persecute you for that by way of removing you from your job, then so be it. You know what I mean? Like, at the end of the day, if your employer is sort of treating people in a counter-Christian way or whatever, then I think sooner or later you're going to have to make a stand about the actual issue at stake, even though it is really important, the interpersonal interactions that go along underneath that. I think if I was in his position, I wouldn't rule out doing what he did, I guess is what I'm saying. Or at least in some way taking a stand and saying, look, this is where I'm at, and I want to have a conversation about it, and if it ends up going pear-shaped, so be it.
And of course, as Protestants who believe in Scripture alone as the sole infallible rule of faith and practice for Christians, we are not binding anyone's conscience, saying that you must do one thing or another or you're not a good Christian. You must obey the Word of God.
That's the only must we're giving, right?
That's right.
Yep.
And the second question: how should a company react to controversial stuff like this when dealing with the fact that they are publicly traded and their greatest obligation is to shareholders? For example, by not firing the guy, it would likely hurt their stock price. That one comes from Chris Ambrose in the Slack.
Would it, though? Would it hurt their stock price? One employee having a particular view?
Well, the whole social justice warrior thing is strong in the culture now, which is something to consider, but again, it is Google. They make a ton of money every year.
That's what I mean.
I don't know.
There's bigger factors.
In two months, stockholders are not going to care.
Nope, exactly right.
This is very much a PR move for Google, and in my opinion, PR, and they're following what they believe is morally right to do in this case. So, in this particular situation, I really don't think it's going to be a big deal when being publicly traded.
That's scary to me, though, that Google thinks that it is morally right to fire someone for expressing an opinion. That to me is a huge problem that we can't overlook, and I actually think Google should cop some heat for that rather than being congratulated for it. I think there's a huge issue with someone logically, carefully laying out what they think and painfully stating at the top, going to great lengths to say, this is what I think. I don't I don't want to marginalize either way. I just want to be unbiased in our view of these things and look at it objectively for the good of Google as a whole. I think, I think it's quite scary that the reaction has been expressing an opinion is morally wrong, and therefore our moral right is to fire you for that. That's a pretty big leap, I reckon.
It is scary, but it's not surprising in a culture where truth is dead.
Correct. Yeah, that's true. Yep. We're just swinging at the bottom of the pendulum without an anchor.
In respect to the question, though, you know, like its responsibility to stockholders, I do, even though the basis for their decision, I mean, I think we agree is not good, but the idea of them not worrying about what stockholders think when faced with a moral issue, I think is very respectable. You know, like I think Christian businesses, like businesses that more hold the Christian values than, ones that aren't Christian values should have that same mentality that we're not going to care necessarily how much money this makes us if we feel like it's a matter that goes against what we believe. And so I think if Google's decision wasn't based on what the stockholders think, but based off what they believe is really morally true, I think that's at least a commendable move, whether or not we agree with why they made that move.
Yeah. It's kind of similar to the way Apple treated that one issue with the terrorists. Like with the terrorist iPhone 5C, I forget, it was the San Bernardino shooting. Like, that was something that people were going, like, people were not really okay with Apple keeping, like, refusing to unlock the phone. But Apple stuck to their guns anyway because they thought it was a moral right, like, there's a moral right to privacy. I do think you're right that there's some respectability to that. I think there needs to be analysis of where do these morals come from? Do they, that's not good. If they don't have a solid base of morality, but that's another question.
But we're not going to be like, I mean, we're accountable for all of our actions, right? But at the end of the day, we're not accountable for, purely acting on our conscience. We're also accountable for the action that comes out of that acting on our conscience. So I'm not going to congratulate someone for making what they think is a moral move if the moral move itself is immoral. You know, just because that move agreed with their conscience, that's only half of the equation. If their action that comes out of that is actually objectively wrong or is counter-biblical or unfair, and bad for the human on the other end, then I'm not going to support that just because they did something that, you know, was right.
They sincerely believed in.
Yeah.
I want to say I agree with that, but the specific question was how should Google, like, what is the responsibility of a business when it comes to the stockholder? And so in answer of that question, I think the responsibility of a business is to do, you know, what they think is morally right, more so than worry about the stockholders.
Oh, you're saying it's a moral responsibility, not a financial responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And then what? Now I don't think they should make the wrong moral choices, and we shouldn't commend that, whether or not. But whenever it comes down to the specific question, worry about stockholders, not worry about morals over stockholders, I think that is the right way to go. Yeah. Especially for Christian business owners.
I understand.
Nice.
I'm still thinking about whether or not I agree.
I think the decisions made by Christian and non-Christian businesses are still going to be judged by the same standard, which is the Christian standard, because we all believe in God. As in, like, as Christians, we believe that God is God of the Christian and the non-Christian. So I think there's an interesting discussion to be had there, but I think I see what you're saying, Tank. Yeah.
Well, there are also other responsibilities, right? Where you, like, I don't own the business I work for. So there are certain decisions that are outside my sphere of influence or control that I cannot make. Now, if the business or the owner makes a decision that I'm unable to influence or affect that is immoral, then it's my responsibility, potentially, depending on what it is, as a Christian to leave, right? But I can't necessarily make the business do something because I don't own it, you know? So I feel like there's a sphere of influence and a conscience and an objective truth element to this very complex question. There may even be more, but that's just the ones I heard in the last few minutes with you guys.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I have a really quick question. It's like a yes or no. Would you now, after if you were working at Google right now, after this has all happened, it's been released, there's been a big media hoo-ha, and James has been fired. Would you, as an employee, stand up and say, that's me too? I generally agree with where he was coming from. Or would you sort of keep quiet and try and fly under the radar? Once something like this has been put out there, it changes everything for the other people who are around in that business at the time. So would you or wouldn't you?
Good question. Let's all answer yes or no. I'll start. I would not, because I want my name to be wedded to Jesus and his authority and character and not political views or parties. So in as much as I can not compromise what is biblically true and still remain a faithful witness to people who don't know Jesus at Google, I'm going to do that.
Good answer.
I would say no too, because identifying with something that has been vilified is like there's a I don't remember which company or person said this, but I've heard like it's better to be engaged with something than to separate yourself from it, even if the thing that you are involved with it, like you don't agree, or even if the company that you are involved with you don't agree. So I think in this case it was like someone justifying being on like Trump's advisory council or something like that. Better to be engaged than to step away and have them not have your opinion at all. I would rather stay in the shadows and give my opinion as it's relevant, rather than to be crucified right away without having any effect.
Yep, I'm with the, I wouldn't say like publicly, I agree, like send out a company-wide email or send it to the bosses or whatever. but at the same time, I'm sure this conversation is a hot topic at Google and people are going to be talking about their opinions. And if I'm asked directly, then I think I would, that's where the yes comes in, that yes, I would speak, my beliefs in this. And I think Ben said it very well, is try not to wed myself, as he said, to the article, but wed myself more to Jesus. I really like that way of looking at it, but I think no publicly, yes in daily conversation, because it'll definitely be asked.
Very good, important distinction. I will not lie if someone asks me what I think about something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So very important. I didn't think about that. And the trick is, Tank, we're all already fired by Google because we're going to put this on the internet.
Nice. Well, my name's Tank, so they don't know who I actually am because I'm Tank.
Yeah, that's right.
Craig, what do you think? How would you answer your own question?
I don't know. If I wasn't necessarily planning on answering my own question, but I guess I can do that. I'd be tempted, if I'm honest, I'd be tempted to put my hand up. Not because I want to be more aligned with James than with Jesus or something like that. I don't, obviously I'm with you guys on that. Like, I want it to be wedded to Christ and what he's saying about the world that we live in, rather than just following along and jumping on a bandwagon with something that's already happening. I probably would. I can see what Derek's saying about, working for change and swimming against the tide, even if something's not going the way that you would prefer for it to, because engagement might be better than retreat. I sort of understand that argument, but I've been in some situations like that before, and I also feel like that doesn't always have the desired outcome. The desired outcome is not always possible, and sometimes that comes down to who are the other personalities that you're working with and how strongly are they swimming in one direction that you're trying to swim against or have input on. So I guess I would be, I'd be the same as what Tank said. I'd be probably not coming out with a huge public, hey, it's also, I'm also on the bandwagon. If people ask me about it, I'd be truthful and say, well, yeah, I think there's a lot of value in where he was going. But I'd probably also just be wanting to be prayerful about my role at that company. That sounds like a cheesy Christian answer, but I think I'd want to be thinking long and hard about and praying about You know, what does this mean for me as the, you know, the one within the many? Can I effectively be someone who stands up for the truth of the gospel in this place, or is this place intentionally trying to squash that truth and that sense of an objective standard? And if that's the case long term, then it might actually be that I take action on that part and remove myself or whatever, if I think that that's, you know, becoming detrimental to me as a believer, or to my health, or, you know, my mentality. I don't want to be going to work every day thinking that I'm working for an evil employer. That's not, I'm not going to be the most productive and all that kind of thing. I'm not going to be honoring them and all that kind of thing, if that's the way that I'm sort of framing the issue in my mind. So, yeah, I think it'd be like, no publicly, yes, in honesty, and then discernment sort of from this point on, and prayer to work out what to do next.
And with that, that's our take on the Google memo. You can connect with us by jumping in our Slack team. Sign up at slack.techreformation.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at techreformation.
You can tweet at us, or you can even DM us if you have a long thing to say in response to this. We'll read it and respond and that sort of thing. So yeah, we'd love to hear from you about this topic if you have more thoughts that you think we left out.
This has been Tech Reformation. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. And I ain't looking back.